and welcome to Two Chairs Talking, a podcast hosted by myself, David Grigg, and my co-host, as always, Perry Middlemiss. Good afternoon, Perry. How are you today?
Pretty good, thanks, David. Pretty good.
Okay, later on in the podcast today, we're going to feature an interview with Bruce Gillespie, talking about his long-running magazine, self-published magazine, SF Commentary, and in effect is his whole introduction to science fiction fandom in Australia and what he's done in that. So we'll feature that later. But I thought before we did that, we might do a bit of an introduction to what fanzine means and what the whole concept of an amateur press association means for those who are not science fiction fans or haven't been involved in science fiction fandom for very long. So fanzines. Well, fanzines to me are self-published fan magazines. Indeed, they start off being called fan mags and were distributed by science fiction fans in the days of the science fiction magazines, the pulp magazines, in the 30s and 40s. And it was a means of communication between science fiction fans who had no other means of communicating because, of course, in then there was no internet, long before the internet, long before personal computers, long before photocopiers. And initially, the only method of communication between science fiction enthusiasts was the letter columns of science fiction magazines. But then some people started to publish their own little self-published magazines, and it sort of went on from there. And the term fanzine was coined, I believe, in about 1940. Then it was adopted throughout science fiction fandom, and after that has been adopted by many other groups of enthusiasts. So, Perry, what was your first introduction to fanzines? When did you see your first fanzine?
Well, I'd heard bits and pieces about them, but I think the first one that I can really remember seeing was one that I picked up at Space Age Books when I passed through in 1975, a copy of The Alien Critic by Richard E. Guise. Funny sort of fanzine that it was, with lots of letters from various people, including a number of authors as well as general readers. And that was the interesting thing about fanzines when you got into them, depending on who wrote them and what they were about, and we can talk about all the different styles of the fanzines later, but you ended up getting a number of magazines which had famous authors writing letters to the editor, talking about just various stuff, sometimes about science fiction, sometimes not, sometimes about anything else. And so it just seemed to be really peculiar to me. And I sort of was reading this when I was hitchhiking around Tasmania and thought it was quite interesting. That was probably what you would refer to maybe as a gen zine, as they're called, a general interest fanzine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or general...
General distribution,
yeah. Yeah, I think it basically covers both of those.
General distribution, yeah.
Different from the style that would be a perzine, which was a personal interest magazine, which is basically a small magazine, which was sort of the earlier equivalent of blog posts or Twitter posts, if you like, where people talk about themselves and what it is they do and the people they interact with. And again, different from those that were referred to as sircons or serious constructive criticism. Well, that is the type of fanzine that Bruce Gillespie is most known for, but he's actually sort of almost found a way to be able to have his serious constructive criticism in with a whole lot of stuff that he writes about. One of the recent fanzines he wrote about was an obituary for his cat. And so that's the type of material that you get. And it's really gives you a really good idea and a good flavour of what the editor of the fanzine is really interested in. And that's the sort of stuff we're interested, that's the stuff that we like.
Yeah, sure. You've distinguished general distribution fanzines, like the one you mentioned, and Bruce Gillespie's science fiction commentary. But the other type of fanzine, which I was certainly how I became interested in the whole area, and indeed really was my introduction to science fiction fandom in Australia, is the APA zine. And an APA, which is APA is the initials of the of an amateur publishing association or amateur print association. And that's quite an interesting phenomenon, which is where a group of people put out their own individual self-published magazines, but they only produce a small quantity of those, and they send those to a central distributor or an official editor, who then puts together or collates them all. So there's a pile of individual people's fanzines, and then mails them out to the mailing list. And that's the Amateur Publishing Association. And I find from Wikipedia that the concept of that goes back way into the 1875, something like that, when they were originally started by people who were literally self-printers. So there were amateur printers who enjoyed printing their own material. And so in the days of letterpress, they put together these beautiful-looking letterpress magazines and circulated them in that sort of way. So that's where the concept came from and was adopted by science fiction fans in about, let me see, what does Wikipedia say? It says in 1937, which was the creation of the Fantasy Amateur Press Association, or FAPA. But my introduction was through our local APA, which is ANZAPA. And what happened to me was that I was just idly visiting a friend one day when up came a mutual friend of ours, Carey Hanfield, in his little Volkswagen Beetle, and said, "Come on, come with me. You've got to go meet this guy." So Carey introduced me to this very interesting chap called John Bangsant, who in turn introduced us to the whole concept of amateur press associations, and started off by showing us how to duplicate our contributions. Because in those days, of course, this was well before photocopiers, and obviously before the internet, but also before even photocopies became a thing. And so the way to duplicate a magazine back then was to, well, there were a number of ways, but the particular way that John was using a duplicator called a Ronio machine, which was a big drum full of ink, and around the drum you wrapped this sheet of wax called a stencil. And the whole concept here was that you typed onto the stencil, and it made little holes in the wax, and through those little holes came ink, and then the ink went onto the paper, and as the drum turned, it moved paper through the machine, and so you ended up with a duplicated magazine. The only problem was that John hadn't told me to turn off take away the ribbon on my typewriter before I started typing stencils. And so what I ended up with was sort of vague bruises in the stencil rather than little holes. And so
smudges.
When we came back with our first ANZAPA contribution, it was essentially illegible because John did his best to try and get some ink through those little bruises, but it was pretty well hopeless. But then I learned how to do the thing. So Perry, what was your experience of APAs?
Well, I can't remember when I actually first came across them, but I know that it must have been sometime after I went to my first convention. I started to meet fans. I was living in Adelaide at the time, so I was meeting some science fiction fans in Adelaide who probably mentioned something about ANZAPA somewhere along the line. And then I know I was at the first ANZAPAcon in 1978, but I'd been in fandom for a couple of years by then, and I think I'd probably already been contributing to APAs by that time. I can't quite recall, because we're back 40-odd years now, and I'd have to go basically look everything up.
Yeah.
But after AussieCon, I know that there was a big explosion of fanish activity around Australia, and part of that fanish explosion was the introduction of a couple of extra APAs around the place. Mm-hmm. I know that there was, well, a lot of the APAs, as you recall, have a sort of limited membership roster, so that once you get to a certain number, might be, let's say, 30, 35, that if you want to join the APA, you have to wait for somebody to leave. And people leave because either they resign, they give it up, or they don't actually meet the requirements for the publishing, which is normally a matter of the rules of the APA says that you have to be producing a certain number of original pages every 6 months, 12 months, whatever. If people don't meet that, then the editor can ask them to, sorry, but you're now no longer a member of the APA because you're not meeting the requirements. And so you have to wait for people like that to drop off. Now, it might possibly have been that I was on the wait list for that. And while being on the wait list for ANZAPA, I was probably already a member of APES, which was the Adelaide Publishing and Editing Society, APA, run initially by Alan Bray and Jeff Harris in Adelaide. And so I was probably on that. I know at a later time, I joined for a while Apple Source, which was a, I don't think that was an acronym of any sort. If it was, it was a heck of a long one, for an APA out of Sydney, which lasted for a few years, and I was in that for a while. But it was generally APES and ANZAPA that I was in, and then after a while, your interests move off and you go somewhere else. And I was in and I've been in and out of ANZAPA over the years. I'm not in it at the moment. It's not one of those things that I'm really interested in just at this point, purely and simply because there's only a certain number of things you can do.
Yes.
And, you know, that possibly I will get back to ANZAPA at some point. I can see myself doing that in the years ahead, but we'll wait and see.
Well, it like ours, is a venerable institution. It has been running for 50 years and a bit now. I think because I attended the 50th anniversary last year, so it was started in 1968, so it's certainly been going a long time and is still being run. And in fact, is being the official editor is Bruce Gillespie, who we'll be talking to shortly. So yeah, so it's an interesting institution. It's a good way to communicate between friends. It certainly predates all of the social media things, which in some ways have sort of have really supplanted it, I suppose. It's not really something of this day and age, but it still has its attractions and still has its interest. The fact that you can design how your contribution looks, you can include images, you can include your own designs. So there is something still to it. I think it still has a certain charm to it. So that's fine.
This episode of the podcast, we feature an interview which David and I did recently with Bruce Gillespie. Bruce has been publishing his fanzine or magazine, SF Cometry, for an amazing 50 years this year. As the title suggests, it's a self-published magazine of comment and analysis on the field of science fiction literature. When he started 50 years ago, it was rare for anyone to seriously consider science fiction as literature, but as you'll hear, he was following in the footsteps of the Australian Science Fiction Review, otherwise known as ASFR, published by John Bankson in the mid-1960s. The following interview has been edited somewhat. We've excerpted Bruce's recollections about Ozicon, the first world science fiction convention to be held in Australia, and we'll include those excerpts in a later episode. Here's Bruce.
We lived in Oakley until I was 12, and then we went out to Sindel, and then my father wanted to get ahead in, well, my mother wanted him to get ahead in the State Savings Bank. The only way he could become a manager, well, he was pretty young, I think he was only late 40s, which was very young for managers at that time, yep, was to go and be a manager of a one-man branch, which were opening up all over Victoria. So he was sent to open the Melton branch, and Melton then was a small, very small country town. So we went out there in 62. We didn't particularly like Melton because then it was just windswept fields and, a small village.
Yep.
Now it's, 50, 60,000 people or something.
And growing fast.
Yes, yes. I was also going to university from Melton, and then my father got his next promotion was to Bacchus Marsh, which we already felt part of because I went to school 2 years, my last 2 years of high school were at Bacchus Marsh High School.
Oh, okay.
So we really enjoyed being in Bacchus Marsh, but it meant the travel to Melbourne was fairly prohibitive. You got a lot of reading done, put it that way, on the train from Bacchus Marsh to Melbourne and back again. And there are only three or four trains a day. So, but meanwhile, Mervyn R. Binns, who I didn't even know who he was behind the counter at McGill's news agency in town. And every little book, every science fiction book that he sold, because it was the only place you could get a lot of science fiction, had a little notice for the Melbourne Science Fiction Club. Unfortunately, they were on Wednesday night, so I couldn't attend. But I knew about it. And the other thing that I did see was an article written in the Bulletin in 66 about the first of the current series of conventions, the convention which actually started off Australian Science Fiction Review, although I didn't know that at the time. But I was at uni. I knew it would be death if I joined. I knew about fandom through IF magazine. There was a series of articles in IF magazine, but it would be death to join while I was at university, because I knew I wouldn't finish my course. I knew I'd get in. So I just left the whole thing until I'd finished the degree. But I had this interest. I thought, well, why, if I'm writing all these essays in English, you know, about the top authors, why not apply them to science fiction authors? And I didn't realise that people were doing this overseas. The only hint I had was that I was able to buy Australian Science Fiction Review on the front counter of McGill's. And that's why many of us got involved. And there it was. And in fact, it was monthly for a year and a half. And if it wasn't monthly, I'd go up to this man behind the counter who turned out to be Merv Binns. You know, what's happened to it? And he said, I don't know.
So what year would this have been?
Well, 66 was when ASFR started. And then I bought it all the way through 1967, which was my third year of the degree. And at the end of that, I write these essays about Philip K. Dick, quite long essays, because there have been long essays in ASFR. John Foister had done these quite huge, and he'd done the special Cordwainer Smith issue at number 11, which was one of the great magazines that I have. So, okay, I sent this off to the editor and put my little check in for a finally subscribed, more or less as the magazine was going under, but anyway. I sent it to her, and we were in Bacchus Marsh, and I got this truck, as they were called, trunk calls then, because they're quite expensive, from John Bankson in Infantry Gully. And they more or less said, well, why don't you come up and meet us one weekend? We're having this weekend. And, of course, I'd never stayed with anybody. I was completely, with strangers, I just had no idea what I'd do, but in retrospect, it just seems extraordinary that I did it at all. Anyway, I went up and I was met at Flinders Street Station by Diane, who was John's first wife, and we drove up to Ferntree Gully. But I was actually going to stay at Lee Harding's. So, I mean, Lee and I got along extremely well, and he immediately began his campaign to educate me in classical music, among many other things. So I was actually staying there, but there was an afternoon, the Saturday afternoon was at John Bankson's, and there I met for the first time many of the people that I've had most to do with in the rest of my life. Because what I didn't realise, that although George Turner had been writing for ASFR for a year, nobody had met him except John Bankson. So this was actually the weekend to meet George Turner.
Oh, okay.
So you had Rob Durand, Damien Broderick, John Bankson, of course, John Foister, Tony Thomas, all these people, those who are still alive are still around. Well, Damien, of course, is in America. I didn't meet Lee Edmonds that weekend. It took me about another 6 months to meet Lee Edmonds. But anyway, it was quite a wonderful. And so I'd met these people. I kept writing stuff for John Bankson, but of course ASFR was on its downer during 1968. But I did get to meet fans. And also my first convention was the Easter Convention in 1968.
In Melbourne?
In Melbourne, at the old Melbourne Science Fiction Club.
All right.
Upstairs at Somerset.
The top of McGill's Warehouse.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
So this was just a one or two-day?
3 days.
3 days?
Yeah, it was Easter. But it was upstairs. They could only fit in about 60 or 70 people at most, but that was about the number who turned up.
So that was 1968.
ASFR's
slowly fading off into the sunset.
I have absolutely no way at that stage of producing a fanzine. Well, I mean, the background is that I would produce my first fanzine when I was in third form at Oakley High School with my friend Ron Sheldon. But Well, I didn't know the term fanzine, and I certainly didn't know about fandom. Just that my impulse was to produce magazines, and we did 20, nearly, I think over 20 issues in 1 year.
Okay.
And it's the only fanzine I've ever been associated with that ever made a profit. Because we made 7 and 6 pence profit for the year, but Ron donated it to a charity. So.
Good on him.
And we were able to do that because his father was a headmaster of a primary school and had a duplicator.
Oh, okay.
And Ron had a typewriter, and I could use my father's old Underwood. So
this is where you started to learn how to use duplicators,
yes.
At a very early age.
No, I didn't use the duplicator. I'd learned how to type stencils. That was the important thing.
Oh, right. But even learning how to type stencils was a skill that has been now completely forgotten about. But that was one of the things that not many people could do properly.
Yes, well, more importantly, in the holidays between second form and third form, I sat down deliberately and taught myself to touch type.
Oh, okay.
Which is one of the best things I've ever done in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've been in industries where I've needed a type for about the last 50 years and I can't touch type. Can't. My kids are learning it all the time, but that was a pretty good thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
So you've been producing fanzines at high school. You're now producing, or you're now not quite producing yet, but
no,
you're...
No, because I didn't have most of the equipment.
Are you starting to get an inkling that that's where you want to head?
Oh, yeah. I knew exactly what I wanted to do, but I didn't have any means of doing it until I finished the whole university course and had a salary. There's no way I could even post the things. But what happened, of course, is I got talking to Lee Edmonds during 68, and he and John Foister between them, but mainly Lee had the idea of this organisation called ANZAPA. And, of course, I actually had heard of APAs through these articles in IF magazine by Lynn Carter, of all things. And he described the whole basis of American fanzines and talked about FAPA and whatever.
Yep. So that started, that sort of kicked off in October 68.
68. So anyway, they put a typewriter in front of me and I typed 3 or 4 very badly typed stencils. And ran them, so I actually, that's why I'm in ANZAPA, the very first issue.
Okay.
Not that at that stage I could produce anything for myself, because Lee was willing to run them off for me.
But at least you were there and you were in it and started.
Yes.
Right. And that's from there, October 1968.
Right. So okay. So at the end of 68, I finished Dip Ed. And instead of being sent to a city school, I was sent to Ararat. To a technical school, in which I was absolutely at sea because I wasn't even teaching what I'd been trained to teach. I'd been trained to teach history, so they gave me this thing called social studies with very little guidance on what to do. I had to make it up as I went along, basically. Okay, so I'm up at Ararat, feeling very isolated, but I'm still determined to get the fanzine done. But at the most extraordinary... this gesture, but well, it was the whole ASFR team. I think it was Lee Harding, probably Lee Edmonds, and certainly John Foister, who actually, I typed the stencils for the first 2 issues, and they actually ran them off, collated them, and when I sent the envelopes, put them in the envelopes and sent them out, and I just can't imagine anybody doing that sort of thing for somebody else in fandom these days, or at any time. It's extraordinary that they actually did it. And of course, I think eventually we got it in the mail about March 1969, and then started to get a most extraordinary response from overseas because John Bankson gave me all the articles that still hadn't been published in ASFR, and he gave me his mailing list, and that was the really important thing, because I got quite a few subscriptions immediately from John Bankson's mailing list. The most extraordinary thing was that period was getting a letter at first from Philip K. Dick himself, because I'd sent them off to Doubleday. And Doubleday had sent them to him, and he'd sent a letter to me. So.
Well, in terms of the history of science fiction and critical reviews of science fiction, It was a fairly early period, and there wasn't really a lot going on at that stage, just about anywhere, was there?
Well, yeah. No, it was all in, the point is, it was all in fanzines.
Yep.
So, and that's why, and it wasn't academic. Well, there are a few academic essays from time to time, but there's a lot of really quality stuff going on in fanzines, of course. And
there would have been people like James Blish and William Mathing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they were in, he had a column in Richard Bergeron's fanzine, anyway, which had all the top people in it. And you had all these people writing, all this was would write for Vector, which was the fanzine of the BSFA. Aldous was the person who most wanted professional reviewing and critical, critical magazines to come out. And he and Harry Harrison did two issues of something called SF Horizons, but that's they were only able to do two. In other words, the academic magazine started in 73, really, with Science Fiction Studies.
Oh, yes. Yep.
But what they wanted to do was to make it incredibly academic.
Oh, yeah.
So everything had to be written in the dullest prose possible.
Yeah, with massive numbers of footnotes and all over the place, yeah.
So there was still the sort of thing that I was doing. There was still a huge number of people out there who wanted to write what I wanted to publish. So. Yeah, there are plenty of that.
So you came along pretty much at about the right time.
Oh,
everything
yeah.
sort of fell into place. This synchronicity can work sometimes. You know, ASFR sort of fades away and then you step up and
I was just as John Banks and you just can't make money on fanzines.
No.
I mean, I don't think he ever had much interest in science fiction. What he loved was the fandom thing and the letters and whatever. Well, that prompted that great exchange with Lee Edmonds, and Lee Edmonds wrote, "Do you have to be Samuel Delaney to appear in ASFR?" And he wrote back, "No, but it helps." In other words, that was Delaney was exchanging letters with John Foister. So John Foister is central to all this because John Foister was the intellectual heart of ASFR. He probably did most of the donkey work for most of that time. Encouraged me. His most extraordinary thing was he did his own little fanzine, which made contact with all the top critics at the time. And when that faded away, he allowed me to reprint the complete Journal of Omphalistic Epistemology, short, in SF Commentary 19, and that was the first really big, decent sort of issue that I did.
So you've been in Ararat for a while. How long?
Two years. I don't know how I survived it. I mean, if it proves that you're no good at teaching. It's a sheer torture to keep going.
Yeah.
And so what I did was, I didn't know what to do. I'd applied actually for a cadetship at the Australian at one stage, but when you put down clubs, because I'd probably put down Melbourne Science Fiction Club.
That wasn't the club that we're thinking of. Melbourne Club.
Savage Club.
And of course, what I didn't realise, journalism is the most hidebound socially, probably still, but certainly then. I mean, it's a very, very, very close circle.
Very difficult to break into. Yeah.
Okay, so that didn't work, but I made friends with Peter Innocent. He had a friend who was a writer called Owen Webster, and I met Owen and I met his family, lived out in the country, so I went to visit them. And I just didn't know, but Owen was the sort of person who liked giving advice. And I described the situation. He said, "Look, you've got nothing to lose, just resign."
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that I might then have had to pay back the entire studentship.
Oh, okay.
Because that's how I'd gone to university. We didn't have the money for
that. That's right. Oh, that's right, because it was student fees at that stage. This is before Whitlam.
Yeah, it was with student fees, but you escape those entirely and be on a stipend. If you were, because they wanted teachers. They're desperate for teachers.
Yes.
All those schools were still opening up right throughout Victoria and the outer suburbs. So, I faced that problem, but I did send in a resignation in those holidays between 1970 and 71. And then I got a phone call from the inspector who'd sort of been up to Ararat, and we talked, and basically offered me a series of bribes to withdraw my resignation. In other words, the political thing was not to lose teachers. And the way they did it, the third bribe was to go into this thing that I'd never heard of called publications branch of the education department, which was in special services. Now, special services no longer exists, but there are a whole lot of different departments which supported teachers. And special services did the magazines that took over from the old school papers. They did a magazine for teachers, and they did all the propaganda for the department in a quite separate way as well. So they brought in... So I was one of about five or six people who were interviewed, and it didn't hurt at all the fact that I'd published a magazine for 2 years already. I'm pretty sure that's why... And they said, well, you're on 3 months probation, but nobody ever talked about the probation after. Because what they gave me is a complete course... A practical course in editing and publishing.
Okay.
But by being in the place.
This was perfect for you. You slotted into
something
that has basically stayed with you for the rest of your life.
Right, yeah, because I met many people who I still keep in touch with, like Robin Whiteley and Barbara Selvay, not people who are in fandom, but, we've kept in touch over the years. Mm. So I got this education. It was a fabulous year because on the first day, they said to me, well, we'll come in here and you'll meet the person who's will be your immediate supervisor and show you the ropes. It's a bloke called Gerald Manane, who was...
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's how I met Gerald. And, of course, for the first 2 days, instead of learning anything, we talked about books solid for the... That's when he twigged that I was reading a lot, and he at that stage was reading a vast amount. He had his book list of books he'd put in order as he'd seen the reviews in Time magazine or The Age or whatever that he thought would be worth buying, and then he'd bought them and he was reading them in order. So, and this extraordinary stuff that he put me onto was... many of my favourite books I would never have read if he hadn't suggested them. But at that stage, it wasn't until the next year that he confided, well, I have been working on a novel for about 10 years, which was Tamarisk Row.
Okay. Yeah.
And, of course, he then finished it and put it in 1973. But being in Melbourne, finally, having managed to buy a duplicate, well, I did up at Ararat, duplicator... access to Noel Kerr, who was doing decent covers. Noel Kerr would do these electro stencils, which are quite different from drawing on a stencil, which is what a lot of the American fans did. I didn't have the skills to do that, but I could finally do some decent covers. And also I just the other thing with publications branch is we're all seconded teachers. We're still on teachers' holidays, which was the whole 2.5 years I was there. I had teachers, instead of public service holidays, I had a teacher's holiday. So that's why there's such a vast amount of activity over those 2 years, from 1971, 72 and into 73.
You had a fair amount of spare time.
Well, on the holidays, yes. So
you stayed there for... Two and a half years?
Yeah, well, I wanted to go over... Well, in between... yes, I wanted to go overseas.
So what else was happening in fandom that was impacting you
AussieCon.
So we'll move on.
We'll
move on past AussieCon because we're going to be dealing with that separately. So we've moved on past that, and everybody's gone home from the convention after that, and you're still producing?
Well, that's it. The thing is that the currency... of fanzines is the letter of comment. And what I would get is the most extraordinary letters of comment on all but a few issues. So that's what really keeps you going. And it also led to some gigantic issues in the mid-70s. And I was in my flat in Carlton Street, because that's where I went after I was staying with my parents. And I had all the... 146 pages. So that's 70 little piles of paper all up in the flat. Micheline and Rainer, who was then 5 years old, and she came and visited and said, "Mummy, he's making a book," which I was.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But it wasn't all smooth sailing all the way through, was it?
Well, it's never been financially. I mean, when my finances were down, then you'd have fewer issues a year. Well, the point is that when I came back from overseas, I was invited back to publications, and I would have lost Super or whatever. But I knew from John Bankson that there was such a thing as a freelance book editors. These people existed around Melbourne. So I started exploring. And as soon as I did that, I got about three or four offers of work. And one of them led to, from time to time in my career, I've been basically working for one publisher. And that was, I had a very good couple of years working for one bloke. And that kept me going right through the end of 76. No, suddenly I lost that job. I had to get out of my flat. You know, you have a year in which everything sort of crashes.
Yep.
But two people came along. This was Elaine and her then partner, Frank Payne. And they said, would you like to take over this room? Because we can't afford the rent by ourselves, and I could just afford the rent.
That one room, yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, well, it was two. No, I got two rooms and they had three or something. It worked out. And in fact, the night they came over to make this offer was at the time that the 77 workshop had happened, which the two authors who, overseas authors, apart from George Turner, were Vonda McIntyre and Chris Priest. And they had Vonda with them. So that's the only time I've ever met Vonda McIntyre, was when she was dragged along to this strange person's strange flat.
So, well, you already knew Priest, of course, because you'd stayed with him.
Yeah, of course, yeah, yeah. Well, we had a great... And when he came back in 82, of course, we had... it was very enjoyable catching up with him. But, okay, 1977 is this extraordinary year of being floating like that, not being able to do anything, no money.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, a lot of us have been in those spots for a year or two, where you have no idea where things are going to turn out.
You just got to keep going. Okay,
yeah.
So Elaine and I got together in 78 and then got married at the beginning of 79. So,
yeah.
And then moved into the place in Keel Street, Collingwood.
And how long did you stay there for?
25 years at Keel Street, and then been out here now nearly 15 years.
15.
So okay, I was going to say, so if we look back now of that period of time, how have things changed in terms of, one, fanzines and fanzine publishing, and two, how has science fiction changed over that period of time, do you think?
Oh, well, the huge change in what, in fact, put me off, people forget there was actually an eight-year hiatus, which I didn't do SF commentary. I started Metaphysical Review.
Yep.
I think the best issues I ever did were as a Metaphysical Review, because that involved all my other interests apart from science fiction. But I got what caught me on the hop was really the Star Wars effect. Suddenly science fiction went into boom, extraordinary boom after 78,
yes,
and you couldn't catch up anymore. Whereas, say, in 75, the Hugo winners, I'd read enough to know that they probably were the best five for the year. By 80, I had no idea who any of the new authors were. Do I keep up? Do I give up on science fiction? I didn't know what to do. And, I mean, I'd review various things that I couldn't keep up with the field anymore, and that was the problem. And I think a lot of people would have felt that way. And, I mean, there were wonderful books of that, especially Tom Dish's On Wings of Song, I remember as being one I did a long review of. But it was basically the 60s and 70s authors who were still working, who were still doing the great books like Le Guin, and Philip Dick, of course, was coming to the end. Well, I think he'd already published his last book by the end of the 70s. But anyway, so I just didn't have the money to keep it going. I did start a Metaphysical Review as was a jokey title, which means it covered anything we felt like, and it grew. And, of course, the biggest Metaphysical Review was even bigger than, I think it was about 140 closely typeset pages.
Okay.
Oh, well, that was the change. Part of the change was I discovered typesetting, because we adopted it for Australia Press. Now, we haven't even mentioned Australia Press, which started 1975 when I said to Kerry Hanfield if there was some way of raising the money to keep SF Commentary going. He said, I'll think of something, which he did. What I did is put together all the essays that had been published in SF Commentary about Philip Dick, made them into a book, and we released it, not without great difficulty, at 75, because the printer who'd given this incredibly generous offer, of course, wasn't up to it. So he sent, half the program books were misprinted or something.
Yes, yeah.
But fortunately, all the copies of Philip K. Dick Electric Shepherd, which is the book we did, were okay. That started North Australia Press pretty effectively. Okay, well, so North Australia Press, having been started, it then took its own direction, because then we brought in Rob Durand, then Lee Harding did his book about the 75 workshop, which we'll have to, as you say, you want to go back to. But that was our second book. Then we started to get manuscripts coming in, although not many. It's amazing. Most of them were literally desk drawer manuscripts and smelled like it. Very little. It was Greg Egan's came out of nowhere. That was probably the best of the... even Gerald Manane's... that's because I kept up a friendship with Gerald and I was typing his manuscript and suggested that the Planes would make a very good separate book apart from... He'd had it as part six of a five-parter.
Oh, okay.
But it was only 20,000 words when I said, and there were a lot of books around, there's Calvino and Borges and people like that. So, we did the play, but that's a bit later. Just Australia Press's, it just kept going under its own steam. And as a result of that, everything fits together. In the mid-70s, I was asked by Melbourne Times to do some book reviewing for them. And I would have kept it up, except I got very sick of doing the books that they gave me, if you see what I mean, the compulsory books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that led to me, I can't remember a second name, Susie was in the office of Melbourne Times. And she had one of these great big things, and it was called an IBM Composer. It was directly between the IBM Selectric typewriter and typesetting. It used its golf balls were typesetting. They were fonts. Basically, you could fill it up with 5,000 characters of memory, run it out, then you had to hit it on, and you had to get rid of it at all. There's no storage on the thing. But this is how they were doing Melbourne Times at that stage. You could whip it down, paste it down, and off it goes to the printer. So we, North Australia Press, as an organisation, got one of these IBM Composers, and we did at least five or six books for ourselves, perhaps even more, and also got some work from the people who'd inspired us as a press were the people at Highland House with Al Knight and Anne Godden, and they were people who'd left Methuen and set up on their own in the early 70s. So we did some books from them, and they also were one of the very few publishers in Australia who would do science fiction at all, because they did David Blake, Lee Harding, and a few other people as well. So I did books for them, we did books. Actually, the people we were supposed to be rivals with, which was Paul Collins, Paul and Rowena, and Corey and Collins, we typeset a lot of their books for them. I don't think they made any more money than we did. Yes, well, it was having the IBM Composer, but the trouble is it wasn't in between technology. And fortunately, we sold it just in time. We wouldn't have been able to, because all the publishers suddenly discovered photo setting and was doing photo setting. And then very quickly, of course, they were doing computer setting, computers. And it just was one year after another. It was photo setting 1 year, and then 2 years later, suddenly was computer, and then was computer setting in Hong Kong or whatever.
Yes.
It was an incredibly rapid change.
Yeah. Things moved very, very quickly back there in the 80s, and then, because it went from nothing to getting quite a lot of, you had a lot of technology that could help you do your job. Yeah.
Because one of the things that, fortunate periods of my career was, was working at Macmillan with a very good boss, and he'd arranged this thing called the guaranteed freelance work. That's right. Guaranteed work. And, you know, finally I had a guaranteed income for the first time in about 10 years. So that was very enjoyable as well. When I started at Macmillan, I was the only person working on a computer of any sort for editorial work. And this was one of those wonderful where you put the, let's see, you put your DOS in, took out the disk, then you put WordStar in, took that out, and then worked
on it. Okay. Yes.
And that was the very first, and the only other computer in the place was for accounting. And everybody else was still doing all their editing on paper. So I did that for several years, and then I started using a program called Ventura, which is a great desktop publisher. The trouble is it was never released for Mac, and that's why it was doomed.
Mm-hmm.
But what it did have was this extraordinary way in which they, if you set it up properly, you could do WYSIWYG under, what, you know, proper screen under DOS.
Okay.
It was incredibly ingenious system.
Yes.
It was just that if they'd gone straight to Mac, which they never did because Corel took it over and dug it into the ground. The point is that I was using Ventura. I could use they did one for Windows 3.1 and offered at least I had something I could put on the home computer. And that's what I did. I did not only edited the books, I designed them, left windows for the pictures. In those days, you couldn't put the... And all this sort of thing. So then I could do my fanzines that way. You see, everything gets together.
Yes.
So you get the first properly typeset SF commentary in 1991.
So what are the challenges these days? Postage is a killer.
Oh, yes. Everything that's happened with the internet, of course, is... Well, the internet helped originally because it put me in contact with all sorts of people I'd sort of lost contact with, and especially the Yahoo e-groups, some of which I'm still a member of. Okay, that was... But after that, of course, then people's things like blogs and whatever, I mean, this was completely foreign to me. But the real problem, of course, is as a mail stopped being posted, then the postage rates went up.
Yes.
And it got, and especially overseas postage rates, so that was the killer for me. And the same thing had happened to all the overseas fanzine publishers until Bill Burns started efanzines.com, in which he said, when would that be? No, 2000 must have been when Adobe Acrobat became widely available. And he said, well, if you can send me your fanzine as a PDF, I don't know where he got the capacity from. He has huge amounts of computer capacity. Every fanzine he's received for the last 20 years is still sitting there, including all of John Foister's FNACs, people like Earl Kemp, who it's now for quite a few years since he did his last issue, but he did these fabulous issues purely for e-fanzines. And then other people like me will do enough print copies for those who want them. And in the last, for the 50th anniversary edition, somebody sent me the money to actually do a proper print edition. So you've still got a few fanzine editors who overseas who will send out print copies, and the rest, as I say, this led to a huge boom in SF fanzines after virtually disappearing, I would say, late 1990s. And
now it seems to be making a comeback.
Well, it made a comeback. People have got a bit lazy, I think. Yeah, no, there's still some very good stuff coming out. And it's sitting there, that's the thing. So that's the main change. But I mean, I feel as it'd be really nice to still send out print copies, but I just don't have the income.
And,
it's so expensive, it becomes incredibly
expensive. Oh, yeah. Impossible. I mean, that'll cost $12 to set post. I think
that's a fair bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's too much, really. It's over the top. So do you see You see yourself continuing with it?
Well, as long as I can. I mean, in the end, something either technological, well, basically technological, I think, will get me, and I just won't be able to keep going.
Yeah. But it's been a hobby, and it's been a big part of your life for 50 years.
Well, that's right, because you get the... it's all feedback. I mean, you still got all these... And of course, then people started giving me awards. Well, fortunately, I've always won Didmar Awards, and sometimes not for 10 years or so, but...
And then it comes back again. Suddenly there's Bruce's name popping up from the National Convention again.
Well, a nice one was winning last year for, you know... Well, it would have been nice to win this year the 50th anniversary, but last year was 49 years.
And that's pretty good.
So, and then these lifetime of... I feel as if the Lifetime Achievement Awards are sort of saying, well, you know, you've done your bit.
Stop now, please.
Well, the editorial for the part one of the Marion McNamara over dinner sort of said, oh, you know, I suppose you'll be stopping now. It's a dreadful thought. So made me more determined to keep going.
So thanks very much, Bruce. That's really, really good. I'm really, really appreciative of everything you've been able to tell us. There's a few stories there that I was certainly unaware of, and it's good. And but thanks very much. It's been great, and more power to your arm, and I hope you keep on producing them, because they're a big part of Australian fandom, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. That's the end of our seventh episode. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast through your podcast client. If you like the podcast, let others know about it. Tell your friends. It'd be nice if you could leave a nice review on the iTunes store. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time. Thanks very much. Bye.